prioritizing women with textured hair not a priority for you?
Oh.
And then they think, oh, yes, sorry. We've just been really wrapped up. I still can't get rid of this itch to start this business.
But all the while, you've still got a full-time role.
I had already begun losing a lot of weight. I looked really, really tired. I have two options here. I can stay in corporate, or I can follow this passion that I have and this desire to create something that I know is missing. There's still a need for Treasure Trust. I need to bring it to life.
How do you launch it?
Black women account for 2% of the population, but 10% of the spend on beauty in the UK. We massively over-index, but yet we're still not catered to. You can't go into Tesco and expect that you're going to get your full wash day experience.
Sisterhood and community to form bonds of shared unity. This guest's brand really walk what they talk. And from a culture where women support each other to stay winning, it's now a place where your dream products can be bought.
And so we ended up building a waitlist of 12,000 women who wanted to subscribe but couldn't.
Wow.
Yeah.
How many boxes are you sending out today?
Oh, that's the million-dollar question.
Greetings, I'm Ashley Samuels McKenzie.
And I'm Charles Parkinson.
And welcome to How I Became,
where we unveil the unscripted journeys of inspirational figures.
Hi, my name's Jamelia Donaldson, and this is how I became the founder of Treasure Trust.
If you enjoy the show, could you do one thing? Subscribe. Wherever you are, just click the subscribe or follow button. That simple act can help us grow the podcast in a big way, and we need your support to do it. And if you really want to help play a part in our growth, rate us on Spotify or leave a review on Apple Podcasts. It would mean the world. Thank you. A descendant of Jamaican parents, this guest's mission bridges a gap for those in need. And after facing a life in a structured career, she could not stump her business idea and left her job to make this new hustle succeed. Sisterhood and community, to form bonds of shared unity, this guest's brand really walk what they talk. And from a culture where women support each other to stay winning, it's now a place where your dream products can be bought. Growing fast with ambition sometimes puts you in position for hard lessons to be learned quite quickly. But by staying determined, focused and learning, you can bounce back from all challenges swiftly. So now we'll share how she became from the start of her life. And that will only get better as yet. Welcoming Jamelia Donaldson, founder of the Treasure Tress.
Oh, beautiful. Can I use that?
Of course. Yeah.
That was really nice. Thank you.
Pretty good. So there's your life in a poem. Wow. Now we delve into the story of how you became founder of Treasure Tress,
mm-hmm.
which is a business you started in your bedroom.
Yeah.
8 years ago. And you ship boxes around the world with hair and beauty products. And you have 13 employees now.
Mm.
You're currently running a pop-up in Birmingham until the end of the year, 2023. So tell us, for those who don't know, what is Treasure Tress?
So Treasure Tress is a monthly product discovery service. So we help you discover and deliver to your doorstep the latest and greatest hair care products. So it's a really efficient way to try new hair care without leaving your house. And equally, it's a really good way to discover and just gain some education on how to use products without having to do the extra legwork of finding out on the internet. So it's essentially everything that you need to take care of your hair in a box, sent consistently to help you keep up with your self-care.
Love that.
Yeah.
Got it down.
Yeah, smooth.
The elevator. Smooth. So I think what people are going to learn from this story is just, I think a lot of people resonate with the story you've gone on and been on, which is you're in a job, you're working, you may be going up the corporate ladder, but you've got this idea, you've got this thing just there and you're
burning,
like...
Burning passion.
That's it. I'm wanting to create it. But for so many people, that they don't make the leap, or maybe they will, you know, and they're going to learn from your story, how you did it and how you just made that decision to just break out of the corporate and start it, or how to do both at the same time. And that whole journey, which is fascinating. And it is it's an amazing business where it came out of a real life problem that you faced.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll get to that. And in the other side of the world, which is pretty cool. But let's go back to where it all begins.
Mm.
paint the picture. What was your life experience that you were born into, and just paint the picture of that very early life.
Sure. The life experience that I was born into, I would say, I would first refer to childhood. So it was me and my older brother. I also have a younger brother, but he's my half brother. Well, I shouldn't really say it. He's my younger brother who has a different mum. So we didn't grow up in the same household. I grew up in the same house as my older brother. It was me, him, and my mum. My parents got divorced quite young, so I don't actually have many memories of them being together and us all being in the same household, although it did happen at one stage. But it was always just me, my mum, my older brother. My childhood was filled with a lot of travel and a lot of adventure, primarily because my mum's a teacher. So for her, everything had to be rooted in education. So half terms, museums, holidays, new experiences. Thankfully, we have family in a few different parts of the world. So it was always, there was always someone that we could go and stay with to have a new experience. Nice. But for her, it was like nothing was more important than education and travel. Okay. So for me, I think it kind of like created this early itch for me to just want to explore the world and see what else is out there. And equally connect the dots of what is elsewhere in the world, but doesn't exist here in this part of the world. So a lot of traveling, a lot of education, a lot of consistent learning, and also a lot of time with friends. Like a really key part of my childhood and my teenage years was the group of friends that I've had for a really long time. I met my best friend when I was 2 in nursery, and she's still my best friend to this day. So I've got some like really long-term friendships that I think really help you stay centered. And it just feels really safe to have like this group of people who have seen so many versions of you and still love you and always create space for you. So I had a fun childhood, I would say. I'd done a lot of activities as well. So I was into athletics, 100 meters. My mum really tried to get me to go down the music path.
In what way?
She forced me to do violin and piano. Violin, I absolutely hated. So I think I lasted about a year and then I was like, please, like, I don't want to do this.
Can't do this anymore.
Piano, I love hearing other people play. I love watching other people play. I liked it when I learned a song that I liked. So like if I could learn an Alicia Keys song, I was like, okay, now I enjoy this.
Yeah.
Anything other than that, I was like, this is so boring. Mm-hmm. So like every time my piano teacher used to come, I always had a different excuse as to why I wasn't practicing, which was quite bad now that I look back because it was a lot of wasted money. But
your mum was just keen for you to learn. She wanted you to just grow as a person.
Yeah.
And you're, as Ash alluded to in the poem, you're of Jamaican heritage.
Mm-hmm.
What were the positive impact of the Jamaican culture on your life in that early phase?
I feel like being Jamaican comes with a lot of natural pride. Like I've never met a Jamaican that isn't proud to be Jamaican. We're just very proud people. So I think that plays a huge part. Jamaican women in particular are very good at forming community and sisterhood. And so the relationships that I have with my friends, I do think that they mirror the relationships that I saw my mum have with other women, whereby they were always there to support each other. A lot of her closest friends by coincidence were single mothers as well. And so between the families, we've done a lot of things together. So we used to do like Christmas together, Easter together. I regard a lot of their children as like my cousins. So if I was to introduce them, say, I'd be like, yeah, this is my cousin. They're not really my cousin, but they're my mum's best friend's daughters or sons, which became family for me. So being Jamaican taught me a lot about sisterhood, the power of community and pooling resources together. I think it also taught me the importance of resourcefulness. So I would look in the cupboard and think there's nothing to eat. Give my mum an hour and there was a feast. Like she was able to make something out of absolutely nothing. And in addition to that, what's the second thing I was going to say? She's able to make something out of nothing. And
you mentioned an expression about lemons.
Yes, making lemons out of lemonade.
Yeah, that was her.
That was literally her through and through. And now I look at bootstrapping Treasure Trust, I'm like, oh, this is where I learned that. Like with very little, I was able to just find ways to make things happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw my mum do that so often.
Yeah.
And my mum was a teacher, so it's not like she had this high flying job. But what I saw her do is prioritize the things that she deemed important. So if me and my brother wanted like the latest trainers and tracksuits that everyone in school had, my mum was like, no, sorry. We're going on holiday at half term, and that's where that money's being used. So she was very good at like teaching us how to prioritize and what to prioritize based on ultimately prioritizing life experiences over material things.
What are you getting from it?
I experienced similar thing having a single mum from Jamaica as well. And I think it wasn't until I got into maybe in my late teens to 20s, I realized he took us on so many holidays. I got to experience so much at that age. And now I realize it was to give that experience and that connection.
Yeah.
I haven't quite been back to Jamaica in quite a while still, but she really installed that in. And I think it's important if you can to do that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's do part two of your story in a few years in Jamaica. We'll just all go out there.
That's why a good not? Plan.
I'd like to go.
My dad actually moved back to Jamaica 2 years ago.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, amazing. I went to see him there. Like, he's in London at the moment, but we all went to see him in May, which was really nice because I had never been to Jamaica with both my parents together. And they've got a really great relationship. Like, they co-parent really, really well.
Amazing.
But I was like, wow, as an adult, I'm having my first like traditional family holiday. And it was really nice because my dad took us to his primary school, his secondary school. Cool. And I also learned that my great grandmother had a shop in Jamaica and I never knew. And it was like the central shop in that area where everyone went to get like food and produce. And I was like, this is really cool. I thought that I was the first like store owner in my family, but I wasn't. Nice. There was like women before me that had done something quite similar.
Mm-hmm. And then you mentioned to us about when you were about four, you moved, you moved over to Atlanta.
When I was about nine.
Oh, nine, was it?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. That was one of, like, that was a key turning point in my life, I would say. So my mum was always looking for new experiences, as I mentioned, and an opportunity came up for her to teach abroad in Atlanta. So they were looking for British teachers in particular to come over to Atlanta and teach over there. So my mum was like, why not? So she took me and my brother out of primary school, put me into elementary school, my brother into middle school, and we lived in Atlanta for the year. And it was still one of my favorite like seasons of my life because one, I met so many incredible people. I've actually still got friends from that experience. Yeah. And two, even when I meet people today from America, I'm able to have like that shared experience with them. I'm like, oh yeah, I used to live XYZ and it was a really good experience. And it just showed me so much. But I think in particular, it shifted my perception of society because I didn't think that there could be a society where, I hate to use the word black excellence because it can be a bit cheesy, but there literally was black excellence on every level. So I think in the UK, there's a few people that reach like middle class, but in Atlanta, literally there were black people at every level. So there was black working class people, black middle class people, black upper class people. Like there were just black people everywhere, all different professions. It was the first time I saw a black person drive a Bentley when I was in Atlanta. And I was like, what do they do over here? Like, how do I get a piece of that pie?
Yeah.
And that completely shifted my perspective of, oh, okay, wow. So as a black woman, I can actually have higher aspirations because now I've been able to see people that look like me in those positions.
Yeah.
What did your mother say when you said to her, I want to be a stylist, hairstylist?
I really wanted to be a hairdresser.
All right.
Yeah, she said, you can own a salon, but no, sorry, you can't be a hairdresser.
Like, shut it down.
Shut down.
Literally. And when I look back, I'm like, okay, I understand her perspective because she was just probably thinking of like the local hair salon, like wash, blow, dry, cut. But in reality, stylists today make some serious money.
Yeah.
So if you're styling the right person, it could have been a very lucrative career. But I understand her lens and why she said that.
I mean, it's pretty cool. It wasn't just like a no, you can't do that. It was a no, you can't do that. But
you can do it this way.
Salon, like she had a vision for you. Like,
yeah.
And you kind of developed on the idea.
Yeah.
Which is pretty cool. And at 7 years old, you became a professional dancer. You hit the streets. Tell us about that.
I don't know if I'd say professional, but I always loved performing arts for as long as I can remember. In my childhood, it was almost impossible to come around my house and watch TV without me putting on a performance. Mm-hmm. Like I'd literally stand in front of the TV and be like, guys, look at my new dance. But yeah, it was a really big part. When I was in Atlanta, I continued dance. So I'd done jazz and I'd done street. My mum tried to get me into ballet when I was younger, but that didn't really stick. Neither did tap. But jazz and street dance were like my thing. And I clearly thought very highly of myself, because when I was around 7, me and my best friend created like tickets to our show on like pieces of paper, and we tried to sell it to people that were walking past to see if they would buy tickets to see our performance on like the street. We didn't get any buyers, but we continued to dance.
Oh, well, the reason I mention it, your entrepreneurial, you know,
yeah,
journey begins the there, time. Right? Yeah. Is selling tickets to the show. And you have a difficult situation growing up with your brother.
Mm, yeah.
Your brother at one point needs assistance just to breathe. Mm-hmm. What happened?
Yeah, so my brother was born with a lump in his throat, which meant that he couldn't breathe without assistance. So he had to have a surgery called a tracheal. I should find the name of it. He had to have a trachee. I can't remember what the surgery is called.
Yeah.
He had to have a trachee, which meant that it was literally like an opening in his throat. Most of the time there was like a tube connected to it to help him breathe, because oxygen actually couldn't reach his lungs. Wow. So for a long time in childhood, he was in hospital. My parents were obviously trying to be there as much as possible. But my mum being really mindful of the fact that she didn't want my childhood to be consumed of Great Ormond Street. And so she tried to like make sure that I still had a life outside of it, which I don't actually remember being at the hospital much at all. I just remember that he used to have a trachee, and like if it was playing, you had to be a little bit careful. Thankfully now he's fully recovered and he's like macho man. but yeah, that was challenging for him. And I don't think I actually realized the significance of it until I went to therapy. And she was like, tell me about your childhood. And I was just telling her like, yeah, my brother. Like, okay, what was your childhood like? Oh yeah, my brother was in hospital. And she was like, no, that's quite a big thing. Like that actually shaped you as a person. And I'm sure it taught you some lessons. And I was like, not sure. And she was like, maybe that is a part of like why you're so driven now. Because for a long time, maybe you felt like you had to do something in order to be seen by your parents. And I was like, oh, I'm not sure that that's good, but maybe you've got something there. So now I'm like, oh, maybe I was so into performing arts because it made me visible versus not feeling as visible when my brother was in hospital, even though I don't remember that. So like, I wonder if subconsciously it done something that made me feel like, oh, okay, I have to show up a bit bigger in the world.
Well, I think people will see in your story, you are a very driven person, and we'll get onto that. You go to university.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you plan to study law, right? The plan was to be a lawyer at this stage. What happens?
To be honest, the idea of studying law came from my mum, because she said that me and my brother were always arguing, and I was always arguing, and I was quite good at winning the arguments. So she was like, well, since you're so good at arguing, why don't you become a lawyer? And I was like, if I get to argue and get paid, why not? Yeah. So I was like, okay, I'm going to be a lawyer. And so I was gearing myself up for that. I didn't do A-levels. I'd done the International Baccalaureate, which is 7 subjects instead of 4. And it includes a language, which was my letdown. And then once I got my results, I was like, I already had the uni. I was going to go to Aston University. I was going to study law. Had all planned out.
Life was planned.
Mm. Yeah. And then the results came in and I needed 34 points to study law and I got 32 points.
Oh.
And I was gutted. Like, I genuinely thought it was the end of my life. I was like, what am I going to do now? Like, I can't go to university and study law. My mum was like, you can go to a different university. And I was like, no, like, I've got my mind set on Aston. I've been there. I've like visualized it. Like, I know where I want to go. And she was like, well, why don't you just consider a different degree? So I was like, okay. So instead I studied business and international relations instead of law. And I mean, I'm grateful that I did.
Yeah, I'm sure that helps a lot now with what you do.
Had you not, Treasure Trust may not exist.
Yeah.
Which is pretty amazing.
And the interesting thing is that the business aspect of the degree didn't attract me at all. Like, I actually didn't enjoy the business modules. I wasn't particularly fussed about them. It wasn't what attracted me to that degree program. It was the international relations part. Because as part of that degree, one, it gave me the opportunity to study abroad or gain experience abroad, which for me sounded like free travel. And then the good part about the business was that it required a placement year, which meant that I had to go into the industry and get experience before completing my degree. And I thought, okay, this is cool. Because of the international part, I'm just going to do my placement year abroad, have fun for a year, then come back and graduate. And that's pretty much what I've done.
In your first year after, so you're at uni, you're in your first year enjoying yourself. Mm-hmm. We all know what that first year is like. It's you know, first time moving, you know, living away and everything.
Yes.
And then after Christmas, something very...
Yes. Yeah, so it was... Everyone had gone home for Christmas. I had gone back to Birmingham because I had a job at Kurt Geiger in Debenhams, and one of my best university friends, she was working in Topshop in Selfridges. So we were like the first two kind of back on campus because we were both working retail. We used to like cook dinner together, go to work together.
Did you meet both at university?
In the Yeah. She was one of the first people that I met because a large majority of my university all went to the same college. And so as the two outsiders, we were like, we may as well become friends. So we became friends from there. And then we came back. I went to see her in Topshop, like she gave me a massive hug. And then like 2 days later, I was sleeping and like someone was frantically knocking at my door. And I was like, who is this? Because I was trying to nap in the middle of the day as you do as a student. Yeah. And then they were like, oh, someone's on the phone for you. But he looked really, really serious. And I was like, okay. And then I picked up the phone and the lady on the other side of the phone was like, Jamelia, I'm really sorry to tell you this, but Jade's passed away. And I was like, what do you mean? Like, I was literally with her last week. I was with her like 2 days ago. That's impossible. And she was like, no, sadly, she took her life. And yeah, like her family are on campus. The ambulance is on campus. They're going to get her body. And I was like, this is crazy to me. So I froze for like half an hour, called my mum, and then I like broke down. And she was like, just come back. And so I went back to London and I was like, I'm not going back to Birmingham. And then I think about a month passed and I was like, okay, I'm going to go back to Birmingham and I'm going to finish my degree. But I had never lost anyone that close to me. Like I'd lost grandparents, but at a really young age. So I didn't actually really have a relationship. But this is like the first time I lost someone that I had a relationship with. And that was really tough.
Were there any signs that she was going through a difficult time?
None. Nothing. No, she was like, she had a really dry sense of humor and was like quite antisocial. That was her brand. Like she was very vocal about the fact like she's antisocial. Like she doesn't really like talking to people, doesn't really like meeting new people. But we were able to kick off a really good friendship and a really strong friendship. So there weren't any signs whatsoever. It was a complete shock to me.
And what were you, you know, after this had happened, what was it making you think about life, about?
Yeah. I think it just threw up so many questions because we all know that we're going to die, but you just don't think, you don't think you would experience death at such a young age because she passed away when she was 20, I was 19. So that was really, really young. Like for me, my life is just getting started. So I was like, death isn't even something that I was considering. So it was like the shock and the reality of, oh, wow, like this thing is really finite. Like, once you're gone, you're really gone. And I think that really shaped my perspective of, wow, like, how do I want to live the rest of my life? Like, how do I want the time that I'm here to be best used? And then I think as the internet progressed, the thing that used to freak me out so much was that, like, even if I'd done, like, a search for her, like, Facebook page, it wasn't there. Or if I would search for like, even like, sometimes it's nice to read like tributes that other people have said about someone that you love. And there wasn't really anything on the internet because although like Facebook existed, like Instagram, we didn't really use Instagram. It wasn't that big yet. There weren't as many social media platforms for her to have a really solid footprint on. So it was kind of like, all I had really was my memories, some photos, because we used to take a lot of photos. And that was pretty much it. And I was like, I don't know, it just felt a little bit empty for me because I was like, she was such an amazing person, really intelligent. And I just wish that more people got to experience her. And so I think that really shaped my perspective of, okay, how do I want to live out the rest of my time here?
What's the lesson from that story, Ash?
I think above all, it's about just cherishing the time you have with people. Because I recently lost someone that I grew up with. I was told by her dad actually that I'd forgotten. It was when we were maybe in year one, and we were probably two or three of the whole school of people of color, and she was being chased by some boys on the playground. And I stood up for her, and I didn't think much of it. It's just the right thing to do. But then after school, she ran up to her mum and said, "He's the boy that saved me." And then our mums got talking, and then like every day on a Wednesday, I think she'd come to my house and we'd spend time together. And we grew up for a good few years, and she passed away a few months ago from cancer she was in Thailand as well. So it was quite complicated in getting her home. And yeah, it was just, you then think about the times that you had with that person, right? And everyone does. And it's, I think the ultimate thing is to just cherish people while they're here. You know, send them a message, do what you can, because you never know when your time may be up.
Yeah.
So what do you do with this, you know, this profound moment happens in your life and it shifts your perspective on life. What do you do with this new view and thoughts and maybe motivation or something in life? What happens?
I think immediately I just started to think that I'm just going to do life the way that I want to do it. And so when it came to the placement year, everyone on the business side of my course was doing, like, they were going for the big four. They wanted the consultancies. They wanted the investment banks. And me and one of my other friends, we were like, do you know what? We're just going to go to New York and just find a way to get to New York and just have a really good time when we're there. Like, we'll do a bit of work. We'll gain some professional experience, but I don't want to force myself to go down a super corporate path so early when I could just do something that I wanted to do. And I don't know what it was about New York, because I had been there as a child, but nothing like distinctive happened while I was there. But there was just this pull to go there. And so we got like the most random internships that just meant that we could get the visa to go there. So my friend got, she was studying international relations and sociology, and she got an internship at a theatre company.
Right.
I was studying business and international relations, and I got an internship at a fashion company.
Okay.
And we would go there and just, we moved there, we moved to Brooklyn, and literally every day was an adventure. Amazing. And it was just so enjoyable. And everyone else would come out to visit us or would like see what we're doing. We'd be like, oh, you guys are so lucky. And we're like, yeah, we just didn't want to do what everyone was doing just for the sake of it.
Yes.
Like, what actually pulled us and what felt rewarding for us was like a valuable life experience, as opposed to getting professional experience, which is really important. But I was always like, there's different ways to do it. And I was still able to do that. I was able to go to Beijing and get professional experience. When I came back from New York, I went into finance, so I was able to get the experience anyway. So yeah, I just felt like I didn't have to sacrifice like fun and life experience for qualifications and professional experience.
So did Beijing happen after New York?
So I went to Beijing first.
Okay.
And then when I got back from Beijing, I went to New York.
Right. So let's paint the picture. You're in Beijing. You're there for a month.
Yes.
You know, it's a long time. You need all your clothes.
Yeah.
You need all of your, you know, what else do you need? You need products.
Beauty products at the top of that list. Probably packing those before I pack those.
And obviously you get through a few weeks and your products are getting low and then they run out.
Yes.
But you're in Beijing, they'll have loads of products, no?
No. There are some places you go where just diversity isn't there yet, or it just isn't part of the fabric of how they've developed as a country.
China's got a very long way to go. I should have known. From the first time I got on the train and I was like the center of attention by doing absolutely nothing, I should have known that it was going to be a problem. So I ran out of hair products and somehow I lost my hairbrush. And I was like, right, I've still got a few weeks here. I've still got to go into the office. So I still need to look presentable. So I'm going to have to find hair products from somewhere. There was a Russian supermarket across the road from the apartment block that we were in. So I was like, okay, I'm going to go there. They must have a beauty aisle of some sort. And they had conditioners. They had like some really cheap gel. So I think I got like some Head and Shoulders, but this is like the most basic Head and Shoulders before they even considered curly hair. And then I got some really cheap gel, which was literally like water, done absolutely nothing for my hair. And then I couldn't find a brush. And then as I was walking around, I saw a shoe brush and I was like, do you know what? This is the closest I'm going to get to a bristle brush. I may as well just get it. So I ended up using a shoe brush on my hair.
Wow.
some Head and Shoulders and some really cheap gel, and no more pictures were taken on that trip because I looked crazy.
What are you thinking when you've got a shoe brush and you're just combing your hair?
I'm just like, this is, why has no one noticed that this is an issue? Mm-hmm. Like, this is crazy that something as basic as like hair conditioner and a hairbrush isn't considered for anyone that doesn't fit the appearance of the typical person in China, which I guess is understandable because China's probably one of the least diverse places on earth. But equally, I'm like, why is there not an alternative? Like, why is there not even like one specialized shop or like one market stall that I could find? Because as much as there aren't a lot of black people in China, there's a lot of expats and there's lots of people that move there for jobs, internships, new opportunities. So I was like, how do people survive if you don't live in a country that caters to diverse beauty? And that at that point, I was like, okay, I think there's a bigger issue here. And I didn't think I was going to do anything with it, but I just thought, this is an issue.
Okay. So yeah. The business idea had not performed yet, but you could see the problem and you'd face the problem yourself.
Literally.
So you go back to New York,
mm-hmm.
And then you come across a certain business model out there, right?
Yes.
Had you started to think about starting a business yet, or what's the story
there? I was
in
New York for a good time. That's it. Yeah. Like, I wanted to experience living in Brooklyn. I wanted to go out to brunch. I wanted to eat at all the restaurants. Like, that was my plan. Mm-hmm. And then I went to Target and I was like, this is insane. Like, I went from having like maybe 3 hair care brands in the UK that I can choose from, 0 in China, to literally tens of, I'd say about 10 at the time. There's probably now about 100 on the shelves. Wow. But there were about 10 different beauty brands
that
I could choose from.
What is Target for people who don't know?
Yeah. So Target's like a superstore. So they do everything from food to household to beauty. But their beauty aisles are still one of my favorites.
Right. So it's like an Amazon, but a store.
Literally.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you get really carried away. You go in Target for like a broom and you end with a whole new beauty cabinet and some new cushions and a new outfit. Like, it's just a lot. But I was like, this is crazy. They have so much to choose from. And not only do they have so much to choose from, a lot of them were black owned brands and there were the products. And then there was the picture of the founder of the product in the aisle. So not only am I shopping products that I know are going to work for my hair, but I can actually see the person that created it. And I can see that they look similar to me. So it's likely that their products are going to work. Mm. And I was like, this is the other end of the spectrum.
You hadn't seen this in the UK.
Never, still haven't seen it to this day.
Right. Wow. And so then you come across it. Does the business sort of idea start coming yet?
Yeah. So then I was just looking around the internet, like, okay, what other products are available? And then I noticed that there was just a rise in the subscription box model. Mm. So I found out about the beauty boxes and I was like, this is so cool. Like, I would absolutely subscribe to this. Then I realized, oh, this isn't unique to the beauty industry. There's subscription boxes for dog food, for socks, for ties, for clothes, literally everything. And I thought, this is absolutely genius. Mm. I bet the UK doesn't have this. And I bet the UK doesn't have this for beauty. And then I looked at the UK and I thought, oh, we do have it for beauty, but a particular type of beauty. So as much as I would love the product discovery experience, I would probably throw away around 90% of what's in the box because I just know it wouldn't work for me.
Right.
So I was like, now I can create a box that I know would work for me. And it would also save me having to tell my friends and family, try this, try this, try this. Use this product like this, then use this like this. So it was like an efficient way as well for me to not have to like spoon feed the women in my network beauty advice. Mm. So I thought, this is cool. If by the time I get back to the UK, there's not a subscription box that's focusing on textured hair, then I'm going to do that.
Whoa. Okay. So the business idea has formed. Mm-hmm. You had the problem. You came up with a solution.
Yes.
And you're having a great time out there. Yeah, you are living your best life. Mm-hmm. You've got 2 internships going.
Yeah.
And you get very excited because somebody calls you or you call someone who's sort of overseeing your experience.
Yes.
And you want to share the news, right? What?
Oh my gosh. I was over the moon. So I was working at the fashion PR agency. And I thought, this is like, it's great. They helped me get my visa. But I mean, the first time going to Vogue is exciting. Mm. The second time, not so much. The 10th time, absolutely not. And then I realized that the majority of my time was literally just sitting at my laptop waiting for a new errand to run. And not only was it a new errand to run, but they were asking me to use my own travel card that I had paid for with my own money, bearing in mind that this was an unpaid internship. Yeah. So I was like, this isn't really working for me, actually. And so one of our housemates in Brooklyn, she was talking with one of her friends, and her friend was like, oh, actually, I know this guy called BJ Coleman who works in entertainment PR, and he's looking for an intern. And I was like, okay, well, I'll apply. Like, can you connect me with him? And she was like, yeah, sure. So I met up with him. I think the British accent definitely got him. So he was like, yeah, like, are you ready to start? Start on Monday. Brilliant. Cool. So I split my week. I done half of the week with the fashion PR, and I done the other half in entertainment PR, which was really valuable because it taught me how to pitch to brands, how to organize events, how to form a really good pitch deck, sponsorships. I learned so much. And so I had a check-in call with the visa company, and they were like, Jamelia, so how's it going? And I was like, oh, good. Like, I've got this new internship. I'm so excited. And she was like, I'm sorry. And I was like, yeah, I've got this new internship, and I've just been offered another one by French Connection. So now I'm probably going to split my week in three and work for the three different companies. And she was like, no, 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 you can't do that. You're violating the terms of your visa. And so we're going to have to terminate your visa immediately. Oh, and man. I was like,
what?
What do you mean? I was like, but why? And she was like, because your visa's only for the company that you're meant to be working for. You can't then start working for two other companies. And I was like, oh, well, like, can you just not say? Like, can you just keep it between us? I'm happy to quit them, but I want to stay in New York. And she was like, no, you're going to have to get home as soon as possible. Wow. So then I called my mom, as you do. And I was like crying, like, they're saying that I have to come back. And then she was like, do you know what? One of my best friends is a immigration lawyer. Let me speak to her and see if she's got any advice. And she was like, Jamelia, you need to come back, because if you try to stay longer than they've told you, then you won't be able to go back to America again. And I was like, that's not an option. So I literally got home, and then I had to tell my friend, who was like my partner in crime, that like, I'm gonna have to leave you here. Wow. And I'm gonna have to go back to London. And so I did. It was a very emotional time.
Set up his whole life out there. He had everything.
I felt like I was on a TV show. Yeah. I was in an episode of Love and Hip Hop.
Wow.
Because they were recording it at the PR agency that I was working at. And they were like, do you want to be a part of this episode? And I was like, sure. What do I have to do? They were like, just serve them over the counter. And I was like, okay, cool. So now I was meeting like all of the people from Love and Hip Hop at the time that was so popular. And everyone was like, oh my God. And then literally my dream just died overnight.
It's pain, man. I feel that pain now for you. You know, like, it's one of them as well, where everything's going so well, you're excited, and then you share it, and then, ooh, you know what I mean?
I was like, why is the energy not being reciprocated? Like, why are you not happy for me? And then I was like, oh, right, that's why. Mm. Yeah, not
just fine. The harshness of, she couldn't even say, all right, we'll just, you know, quit those other things.
Yeah.
And you can carry on. It was, no, you've got to come home. How many days did they give you from like that?
I think it was like 20 days.
20 days. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So it was a little bit longer. Find a flight, pack, get home ASAP. Devastating.
So you get back to the UK. And yes. I heard you talk about, you know, you'd watch YouTube videos and you'd see people who were like you with their hair. Mm-hmm. And you'd be like, I want that hair.
Yeah.
But what was the situation in the UK? You couldn't get the...
Couldn't find it. Even predating my trip to America, I used to watch a lot of YouTube. And it all started because I used to take relatively good care of my hair, I thought. And then I remember Googling one day, why doesn't black hair grow? Because it felt like my hair would grow to like this length and not get any longer. Okay. And I thought, like, is there like a genetic fault with us? Like, why is my hair not growing? And then when I Googled it, I came across loads of blogs, because back in the day, those were a thing. And it was, I think one of them was even called like Black Girl Long Hair. And it was all of these black girls with really long and healthy hair. And I was like, oh my goodness, I've not seen much of that in the UK. What products are they using? And then I went on YouTube and I was watching all of these girls take care of their hair, and all of the products that they were using weren't available. And I was like, this is really frustrating. And so as a student, I was spending like £80 a month buying products on Amazon.com, paying for the shipment over here, paying for customs, just so that I could try products that I'd seen online.
Wow. Wow.
And obviously £80 a month as a student is a lot of money. It's
more than Netflix.
Absolutely.
A few Netflix. That's actually all the TV subscriptions.
Literally. Together. All the subscriptions. Mm-hmm. I was like, this is ridiculous. And then when I got back to the UK, everything that I'd got used to using in the US wasn't available. And I was like, this is crazy. I've been away for a year. And at that age, you think a year is a long time. And I was like, how have things not changed? Like, there's still like four brands on the shelves that I can choose from. And these aren't the brands that anyone's ranting and raving about. So I thought, yeah, I'm definitely going to have to launch this idea. I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I need to solve this issue.
Had you started your time at the asset management company?
So shortly after I got back, I realized, quickly realized that I had burnt through my savings because
too many brunches.
Too much brunch, yeah.
Both my internships were unpaid as well. So I had a maintenance grant that I used, and then I had always had I kept a retail job since I was like 16. And even before then I had like an admin job. So I was very used to working, and I was also quite disciplined with my savings, but that money quickly disappeared.
Mm.
And so I was like, look, I've got about a month left before I need to go back to uni. Let me get an internship that's going to pay me well so that I can replenish some of my savings, but also get like a corporate green tick on my CV before I go back to my final year. Yeah. So I was on, what's it called again? Milk Round? Is that what it was called? One of the university like grad job websites. And then I saw a business operations internship at an asset management firm. I didn't have a clue what an asset management was. Didn't have a clue what business operations was. But I looked at the pay and I thought, okay, I think I can do whatever they need me to do in order to get paid that. So I remember revising for that interview like it was an exam. Like everything that I used to do for exams, I'd done that. So I'm very much a visual learner. So I was the person that had post-it notes everywhere. And I was intense. I also learned quite well through hearing. So I would like record myself saying my revision notes, listen to it while I was going to sleep, and then try to recall it in the morning.
Wow.
I actually done that for that interview as well.
Wow.
Like I treated it like it was an exam and I gave it all I had. And thankfully I got the internship.
Nice.
And I was like, okay, this is good. Like I really enjoyed the internship experience. I enjoyed the completely new working environment. I enjoyed getting to know different people. I enjoyed working with people that were significantly older than me, because up until that point, it'd always been like me and like my peer group working in a shop floor, not taking it seriously. But it was nice to be in a different environment and learn from people that were older than me. So month one was really good. I gave it all I had, and they asked me to stay for 3 months, which was a little bit over the time that I'd expected because I needed to be back at uni. But I was like, you know what, I'll do it. And then while I was there, they offered me the graduate position, which was a huge lifesaver, because that's the one thing that they drum into you at Aston, like make sure that you secure your graduate position as early as possible, because you don't want to graduate and be left without a job. So I was like, okay. So I got my graduate position and I was like, brilliant. All I need to do is get my grade and then I'm good. So I had a good final year where I like really put my head down and gave it everything that I had, and then managed to graduate with a first, and then went back to the asset management firm to start the grad scheme.
So by this point, you're like, are you planning a career in the corporate world?
I'm like, I may as well do this. Like the pay seems good. Mm-hmm. So year one, I was like, okay, the pay's good. The people are clever. I can learn a lot. Year two, I was like, the people are nice. The people are clever. Not sure that the women in senior leadership have the life that I want. So I was like, okay, I know that I definitely want kids. Family's really important to me. I didn't see many women in leadership having a lot of time with their children. So I was starting to think like, I don't know if this is the right environment for me. But equally, I was like, I still can't get rid of this itch to start this business. Like there's still a need for Treasure Trust. I need to bring it to life.
So how long had it been by this point since you did come back and like, oh, I should have this business side, got this business idea?
I'd say about a year.
Right.
Yeah, okay. Maybe a year and a half, because in my final year, I had no capacity to focus on anything else. Mm-hmm. I think I actually forgot about it. First year of the role, I was like all in, just trying to learn the ropes.
Treasure Trust is nothing's happening.
It's in the back of my mind, yeah. But I'm just thinking I have to learn what an asset management firm is before anyone realizes that I don't know. So I was just focused on getting my language right. And then by year two, I was like, yeah, I can't let go of this. I have to do something about this. And then I was like, okay, let me just launch it as an Instagram page and start reposting images of women with textured hair, who long hair, short hair, curly hair, wavy hair, kinky hair, just so that I can start to see more images of women who look like me, because I couldn't see it anywhere else. And so it started as an Instagram page. And then thankfully, my then boyfriend, who's now my husband, is a web developer. And so I was like, can you help me just build a landing page so that I can put it in the bio of the Instagram and people who are interested can register their interest? He was like, yeah, sure. Managed to do that. And then I got a DM from a brand saying like, hey, when do you launch? Would love to learn more. And at this time I had like 300 followers. So I was thinking, how did you find me, first of all? And second of all, this is a brand I've been using my whole life. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Like, let's get on the phone. So they had also completed the survey. So I had their email address. So I reached out and I was like, hey, like, would love to touch base, tell you a little bit more about what I'm building, and would love to have you be a part of our first box. I didn't have a box. I didn't know how to design a box, where to print a box, where to source anything from. I was just literally putting one foot in front of the next. Mm. And I was like, there's an imaginary box in my mind. So at some point it's going to come to fruition. And this is the kind of brand that I want to work with. And thankfully to this day, they're still a brand that we work really closely with. They're even one of the sponsors of our store in Birmingham.
What's the brand?
Palmer's.
Okay. And what do Palmer's make that
so
many people know?
So they're really famous for their cocoa butter. Nice. Typically in a jar, also comes in liquid form now. But they've also been getting more involved in the hair space. So they've got like some great shampoos, some great conditioners, leave-in conditioners and oils.
Excellent. And I think there's a good learning there in terms of you're never really going to have everything worked out when you start something. But as you said, one foot in front of the other.
Mm-hmm.
You'll learn, you keep moving forwards, and you will achieve the objective you're aiming towards.
Absolutely. And I think it's also a reminder that you never know who's watching. And that's happened to me a few times in my life, I would say. Like, I've had an interaction with someone and they're like, oh, I actually saw that you done this, or oh, I noticed that you were here, or and I'm like, wow, I didn't even know that you knew I existed. Mm-hmm. So the fact that I was very disciplined with the Instagram page, like the posting schedule was consistent. And even with the web page, I wanted it to look as professional as possible. And I spent a lot of time like thinking about the colors, about the imagery, about the logo. And so I think there's a lesson about showing up the best way that you can with knowledge that you never know who's watching. Mm-hmm. And the way that my mum used to tell me this, and I used to think this is so dramatic. And I think she told me it because I would be doing a chore and I wouldn't do it properly. And I just hope that she wouldn't notice. Mm-hmm. And she said to me, the way that you do one thing is the way that you do everything. And I was like, this is dramatic. Mm-hmm. Like, I just didn't want to clean the coffee table. Yeah. But in reality, she's right. And so a lot of the trust and the relationship that we have with brands is built upon the fact that everything that we do it to the best of our ability. Mm-hmm. So even when it comes down to like sponsorships of our store, no one saw sketches of the store until the very last minute, but they had already agreed to be a part of it and agreed to help fund it because they knew that whatever we were going to do was going to be better than what we'd done previously. And they were happy with what we'd done previously. Mm. So I think it's really important to just do everything to the best of your ability. And on some days that looks like 40% because that's all you've got in the tank, and that's absolutely fine. But I just don't think there's any value in half-arsing anything. Mm. And that's the same sentiment that I had even when I was leaving the asset management firm. A part of why I decided to leave was because I knew that I wasn't giving that job my all. Mm-hmm. And with the view of setting up my own business, I just thought, I don't want to give someone 50% when they're paying me 100%, because I don't want someone to do that when they work for me. Like, if someone works for me, I want them to give me everything that they've got for the role. Yeah. And I didn't want to shortchange my employer, because I believe in karma and I believe things come back around. So yeah, the way that you do one thing is the way you do everything. And you also never know who's watching.
Yeah. It reminds me of time when I was younger, I was at my grandparents' house and my granddad. I think I elected myself to do the washing up and I didn't. I was doing it a little bit, but I wasn't really into it. I was probably about six, but I was trying to be helpful. And then I kind of wanted to give up. And he said to me, whether the job's big or whether it's small, do the job right. Or not at all.
Yes. Yes. That sounds familiar.
Yeah. Yes. The same Jamaican sentiment.
Yes.
I love that. I think for anybody listening now who's got that business idea or got mm-hmm. that thing, that yours is a great story of just get started with something. It doesn't have to be the big launch, the big investment, the big... You just start to set up an Instagram page to begin with.
Yeah.
And that got the ball rolling and then got you noticed, which I think is the key. It's like, just start with something, a landing page. Just do what you can. Mm-hmm. Use people around you who got skills to help you get started.
I'm a huge believer in momentum as well. Like, once you start something and you put it out, it kind of pushes you to do the next thing and it helps you navigate, okay, what is the next step? What's the next direction? And even to this day, I think my team laugh at me a lot because I'm like, oh, guys, we're going to do this. And they're like, yeah, but how? And I'm like, oh, I don't know yet, but I just know that we're really going to do it. So even with Birmingham, I was like, yeah, I started pitching for the store. Didn't have the location as yet, but
this is
I knew
the pop-up store.
Yeah, I knew what I wanted and I knew where I wanted it to be. And there was no way it wasn't going to happen. So I was like, yep, this is where we're doing. These are the dates that we're opening. This is going to be the location. Yeah, people got on board. They trusted us with it and it has come to fruition. So I think there's something about like just putting things out there and consistently putting things out there because you begin to gain momentum, you begin to gain traction, you begin to gain trust. And that just helps propel you to like the next level consistently.
Love that. Great. So if you are listening or you are watching, do that thing, whatever it is, make it website, social media account, something.
Yes.
Or sometimes it's just a Google search. Search the thing that you're wanting to find out and it just starts the momentum, right?
Absolutely.
So you started the momentum. Palmer's has got in touch, got 300 followers. You're like, whoa, okay, this is happening. Mm-hmm. But all the while, you've still got a full-time role.
Yes.
And you launch Treasure Tress?
Mm-hmm.
How do you launch it?
Through Instagram.
Okay.
There was no marketing budget. Not to mention, I'm a first-time founder, so I had no idea what I was doing anyway. I didn't realize that like people put money behind these things. I called my best friends and said, hey, can you be my models? They said, yeah. I called my uni friend and said, hey, can you do the photography for me? He said, yeah. Took everyone down to a studio, including my niece, who was a baby at the time, and had some pictures taken, took them home, used an app to like add text to the photos. And I said, we've launched. And that was the launch campaign.
There you go.
Had a few email addresses, so was able to email as well to say like, hey, we've launched, check out the website, subscribe to pre-order your box. And that was that.
And you're in your bedroom doing on this, basically.
In my bedroom, on the train, on the way to work. When you first start your business, obviously you occupy absolutely every role. So I was customer support. I was brand partnerships. I was content creator. I was marketing. So I distinctly remember one day taking my laptop to work with me, going into the toilet and locking myself in a cubicle and just working through customer service queries.
Wow.
Because people were like, okay, I paid yesterday. My box hasn't arrived as yet. And they didn't understand the business model in that you pay for your box and then your box arrives the following month. But equally, they didn't trust the brand because we didn't have many followers. We hadn't been around for long. They'd not seen a previous box. It was like, are you taking my money or is this an actual business?
You don't want to go on Trustpilot being like, one star, avoid. We've all seen those messages.
Honestly. So I was like, getting back to customers like, yeah, thanks so much. Your box is going to be shipped on this day. And
they have no idea. The person sending the message is in a toilet cubicle with a full-time graduate role.
Yeah.
And that's it coming. I love that. So you must be doing pretty crazy hours. What time are you waking up?
5 a.m.
Oof.
I needed to be in the office by like 7. I was averaging about 7:30. At the time of launching Treasure Trust, I was on the portfolio compliance team, which is like a 12-hour shift. You're meant to be there from 7 till 7. So, and it's also a really important role. Like you're literally approving or declining the trades going through based on the mandate of the company. So for example, some like Arab companies don't want to invest in pork. And so you've got to make sure that you don't allow that trade to go through. So it required a lot of attention. So I was literally there 7:30 till 7, I'd probably stay till 7:30 to make up the time. And then would go home, stay up till 1 or 2 working on Treasure Trust. Like what does a pitch deck look like? Trying to figure out like, where do you get boxes from? Like how much do they cost? What are the colors? Like companies asking me for the color codes. I'm like, I don't even know what that is. So literally Googling everything. So averaging like 3 to 4 hours worth of sleep every night and then going straight into work. And then I remember one day, for me, it was like the signal that you can't do this anymore. I was getting ready to leave the house and I couldn't find my keys, so I couldn't unlock the door. And I literally like burst, I had such a breakdown, like I burst into tears and I was crying. And then at that point I realized the problem isn't that I've lost my keys. The problem is that I'm so exhausted that I'm making silly mistakes and I can't process my emotions because I'm so, so tired.
Yeah.
And then at that point I was like, Jamelia, like something has got to give. I had already begun losing a lot of weight. I looked really, really tired. I just thought, I can't do both. I really can't. And at the time, I was in my early 20s. So I was like, I have two options here. I can stay in corporate, which has got a very predictable future. I was learning a lot about how to climb the corporate ladder because I actually didn't know much about it until I got into there, until I got into the institution. Or I can follow this passion that I have and this desire to create something that I know is missing. It could go really well or it could go really wrong, but I don't have much to lose at this moment in time.
Did you think at this point about the best friend that you lost and her going through her mental health issues?
Yes, absolutely. I don't think I thought about her mental health. I think I thought more about the life that she had lived and the potential that she had. And I thought, I really want to maximize everything that I have. And the reality of it is that we're going to die anyway. Like that was something that resounded a lot for me. Like this isn't forever anyway. So I may as well give it a shot. And my mum was always intentional about teaching me, like, just when you're at work and when you're at university, one, she told me always make friends with at least one lecturer, like have one lecturer that's always going to vouch for you, which I done. And then when I got to work, she was like, just make sure that like you manage your relationships well at work. Don't burn any bridges because the workplace can be very political. So I said, okay. So one thing that I'd done till the very end was showed up as much as I could. Like I was probably running on about 20%, but I gave them the full 20% because in the back of my mind, I thought, I know I'm going to do Treasure Trust, but there's no guarantees in business. So if this doesn't go well, then I want to be able to do a U-turn. And I want to be able to say like, hey guys, you see that position?
Yeah.
Is it still open? Huh. If not, I'll make tea. So I knew that I needed to have that safety net of, okay, I still have good relationships with the company. I can go back if I need to.
So you find this crossroads and you do what we call taking the leap.
Mm.
We've started a business. We started a production company, still going, Unity in Motion 2015. Mm-hmm. And there's that moment where you just have to take the leap.
Yeah.
And it feels like it's this unknown, you know, space. And I was working at the BBC at the time, similar kind of like there was a very clear career ladder.
Yeah.
Where you just know how things are going to work out, you know, kind of what jobs you're going to get, what play you're going to get.
Mm-hmm.
But the world of starting your production company or your company is just unknown.
Mm-hmm.
You have no idea. But you just got to dive into it.
Absolutely.
And that's what holds a lot of people back, is not making that leap into it.
Yeah.
So how did you then made that leap effectively?
I did, but I had a full start first.
Oh.
So I decided, okay, this isn't sustainable. I really want to do Treasure Trust. And so I said to my mum, like, oh, I'm going to quit and I'm going to pursue Treasure Trust full time. And she was like, okay. And then she quite quickly called like her girlfriends. And before I knew it, like every time I was in her room, like an auntie would be on the phone and she'd be like, hi, Jamelia. Yeah, your mum said that you want to quit. Do you know what? I think it's a good idea, but I think you should just keep your job as long as possible. You know, you can do them both at the same time. And so every time I'd have an interaction with a family member, they'd be like, yeah, it sounds good, but I just don't think you should, you know, you've got a really good job. And I think what didn't help was that my mum's a teacher. Mm. And when you're in finance, your graduate salary is pretty decent. And she was like, Jamelia, do you know how long it took me to earn the salary that you're earning as a grad, as a teacher? Like, don't take it for granted. So there was a little bit of guilt in me, like, oh man, like.
That's it's a powerful line. That's like, you know, because it comes from a place of love, right?
Absolutely. And she just ultimately didn't want me to like ruin my professional career.
Yeah.
And I just feel like there was this added pressure as well, because my mum's a teacher, my grandma was a teacher, and even with my grandma being a teacher, she was a teacher in Jamaica, and then when she came over with the Windrush and she went to teach in the UK, they said that her qualifications were invalid, and so she had to train from scratch to become a teacher again. Oh, so it's like the women in my family have grafted for their careers. And I think it probably felt a little bit throwaway for me.
Yeah,
to
you're
just saying,
like,
yeah, I'm just gonna
ditch this thing, mm-hmm. and I'm gonna go on this unknown adventure.
Exactly.
And if you look at all the statistics about startups,
yes.
they don't look good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I was like, okay. And then it got to me a little bit. So I was like, all right, I'm gonna see how much longer I can go. And then a few months passed and I was like, I actually can't do this. Like, it feels like it's soul destroying. Mm. Not because, I'm not going to say like it was a toxic work environment, because it actually wasn't. It was a great place to work, but it just wasn't what I was made to do. And so I just felt like I was denying myself every single day that I went there. I was just like, I just don't think this is what I was built for. Mm. And not to mention, there were people that were really intentional and really strategic about their career. And I just didn't have that same drive. Like, and I'm quite an ambitious person. So for me to not feel motivated also just showed me that I was in the wrong space.
Yeah.
And so I was like, do you know what? I'm going to quit. And I'm actually not having this conversation again. So I'm going to hand in my notice and then I'll tell everyone once I've quit. So the interesting thing is that my mum had the stance of don't do it, basically. And then my dad had the stance of do whatever makes you happy. So they're literally polar opposites. So I kept my dad close. I'm like, okay, so this is what I'm thinking of doing. And then when I quit, I had, it was the day before my last day. And I said to my mum, oh, by the way, tomorrow's going to be my last day at work. And she said, okay. And that was literally all she could say, because it was too late. Mm. I'd handed in my notice. I had done my notice period. It was entirely too late.
Yeah.
And yeah. I think at that time, though, I'd become a little bit immune and a little bit numb to everyone else's responses, because to me, it was so personal to me that it didn't matter how anyone else felt about it.
Yeah.
I just knew that I had to do what I had to do for myself. And if everyone else was disappointed, then I don't know what to tell you. And I also felt like I've done everything that you asked me to do. Like,
yes.
I'd done university, I'd done the internships. Yeah, I'd done as much as I could, but now I want to live on my terms.
Mm.
Yeah. So,
too right, I think. Just important lessons there in terms of when you find your calling, nothing else can get in front of that.
Mm-hmm.
You can kind of think, all right, I'll try this for a bit. Doesn't work. You know, I'll just go into work. I'll make everyone happy. Doesn't work.
Yeah.
The only thing that is going to fulfill that burn inside of you is to do what you'd had your heart set to do.
Absolutely.
And like, again, coming from like parents or descendants of Windrush, especially mm-hmm. here, it's like, they came here and it was a very hard environment for them. A lot of them were sold the dream of coming to the UK and everything mm-hmm. was going to be peachy, when in fact that wasn't the case. They had to go through a lot. They had to work really, really, really hard
mm-hmm.
to provide for themselves, the families that they have here, the families that a lot of them left over
Absolutely.
Home that had to send back for. So, you know, naturally I had a similar thing with my grandparents, where when I said I was going to go to uni and study film,
mm-hmm.
because I spent a lot of time with my grandparents as I grew up, she kind of knew that I was more techie.
Mm.
And she was like, usually I'd want you to be a lawyer or a doctor or, you know, an engineer, but I know that would be good for you doing film, because you're into that kind of stuff, computers and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But I get that for our parents then to have to work so hard for us here. They think, wow, you're just throwing away that job that would have been really, really challenging for them to get
yeah.
when they were our age. But I guess the world's a bit different now, where entrepreneurialism can be accessed by anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas perhaps back, you know, 30 years ago, it was a lot more challenging to kind of get
Absolutely.
Into those lanes.
Yeah. And even for their generation, the people that did manage to be entrepreneurs had to jump through massive hoops. Mm. So one of the like most widely acclaimed entrepreneurs in the beauty space are a duo called Dyke and Dryden. And they were the two that basically brought Black beauty to the UK. Mm. So they started the Afro Hair and Beauty Show.
Mm.
They had like one of the biggest hair shops. They ended up owning like most of the properties along a road in Tottenham. And in order to get the premises, they had to ask their Jewish friends to sign the leases for them. Like any paperwork had to go through their Jewish friend because they couldn't front the business in order to secure the funding or the premises.
Mm.
So entrepreneurship was a completely different ballgame then. And not to mention, my parents' jobs were really safe. Like, my mum's a teacher and my dad was a bus driver. So for them, it's like, what are you doing? Like, we don't know how to do this. No one in the family does this. What are you doing?
That's it. It's that great unknown again. You know, yeah. It's that once one person's taken the leap, they yes. can then tell other people what it's like and help them along the way,
yeah.
as we've all experienced. But mm-hmm. if that hasn't happened yet, or if someone can't give that advice and they just think, just be safe, don't jump over there because, you know, you don't know what will happen.
Exactly.
So you learn the important first lesson, well, one of the first lessons, don't talk too much.
Yeah.
Just do.
Execution.
Do things, mm-hmm. exactly. Because that's it. Later on, when you do certain things, like we're working with Amazon at the moment.
Amazing.
Then your parents are like, okay.
Yeah.
I can understand that. Amazon, big company client. Cool.
Mm-hmm.
Good. I don't get why you started it or really what you do, but that's good.
Exactly.
So you learn that lesson. Mm-hmm. And how do things get started? Are you feeling like, okay, so you've quit. It's just for 100% Treasure Chest. Oh, I'm free. This is great. Living the dream. Absolutely. Is that how you're feeling?
No, absolutely not. I remember the day, I think it was like the first Monday after I quit, and I had like the calendar for the year in front of me. And I just remember looking at it and thinking, what do I do next? Like, okay, I've had people that have pre-ordered the box. How do I get the brands that I want in the box? How am I going to improve the way that I get the boxes to them? How am I going to improve the process so that it's not me packing every single box in addition to doing all of the admin and running the business?
It's a lot of work. Did you have doubt at this point if you'd made the right call?
Absolutely. I did think, like, why did you do this?
You had a good job. You had money coming in.
Do you know what it was? It was the first payday that came and I didn't get any money.
Oh.
And I thought, okay, I'm really doing this. Like, I have no choice but to make this work because that old paycheck isn't coming in anymore. So that was a very humbling moment.
And you do have those days you're like, maybe they were right. Yeah. Oh, no.
Absolutely. But then there's a part of me that just didn't want to admit that.
So no, like, exactly.
I'm going to make it work.
That's it. And that's where the drive kicks in. And that might be a day. You might think that for a
Absolutely.
Day or an hour or a few minutes, but it comes.
Yes.
And then the next day, and then you've got the fire again and you get
Absolutely.
Going. So then what happens next?
I literally just thought, okay, I know that the box needs to go out on this day. Let me work backwards from there and plan my tasks and my to-do list accordingly. So I was like, okay, cool. Need to get a proper account with Royal Mail. Let me do that. Okay, need to pitch to some more brands. Let me start doing that. Need to formalize my pitching because up until that point, I'd been cold calling companies in my lunch break.
Right.
In
Can
conference
I speak to
room.
The person who handles X?
Yes.
And like, who are you?
Exactly. So not only am I cold calling them, but I'm also presenting to them a concept that they've never considered before.
Right.
So the subscription sampling model is really built out in the US, but in the UK, they're like, I don't, like, why? No, we just put our products in retail and that's it.
Mm.
So not only am I trying to win them on the business model, I'm trying to win them as like completely, I didn't have a track record. I had no profile. I had no online presence. So it was a hard sell.
But you make it work. How do you make it work? How do you get those first successes?
Consistency. I think it was like just consistently reaching out, attending events. So if someone declined on a call, going to an event, meeting them face to face, trying to build a bit of rapport with them that way, following up on email, keeping people updated as well. And then I quickly learned the power of having at least one brand behind you. So the minute I had Palmer's behind me, it was almost like a signal to everyone else that, oh, okay. So if Palmer's can trust them, then they must be okay. And so I began to learn, oh, okay, if I mention Palmer's in the first paragraph of an email, people start responding to me. Yeah. And so I started doing that. It's like you just learn every time that a brand didn't respond, I thought, okay, that doesn't work. Then every time a brand did respond, I thought, okay, there's something here that's working. Let me keep doing this thing and let me stop doing that thing.
Yeah, love that. And we had a similar experience in our early days, right? We want to set up a video production company. We know how to film. How do we get credibility? We're really lucky in that first maybe 6 months to work with Wimbledon Village Events and KPMG. And then from there, we had those respectable, refutable brands. And no one then questioned us after that. It made everything else a lot easier, didn't it?
It's crazy how that works.
But like the whole thing about emails and crafting that as well is so key. Like that's, you that's just Charles go through that experience. Oh,
you need something done. Charles knows how to do it. He gets us into places free, gets us free shooting space, all sorts of stuff. That's definitely a superpower.
Okay.
You just learn like, and no reply is not the end of the story.
Absolutely not.
I have been known to send about 8 emails.
7 to 8 emails.
To no replies.
Yeah.
And then eventually it comes round and you just never know what someone's going through because they come back and they're like, oh, sorry, I was on maternity leave. Yeah, this sounds great. Had you not followed up again for a few times or whatever, you never would have heard that. Or I was ill or whatever. Mm-hmm. Or the email are really perfected, right? If you want a response and you're willing for it to basically, I'm never going to speak to this person again, probably, or they're going
to
speak.
I've got one of these. I'm interested to
hear what it is. Okay. We'll right? So I send, it's very simple. And you learn, like, the shorter your email, the better results, right? Long paragraphs, never going to work. People too busy. And so I just say, if they haven't replied, hi, blah, blah. Did you receive my email? That's it.
Oh, that works for you.
Nothing else. And then they have a decision to make.
Yeah.
Email comes in. Am I going to be an idiot and rude and just not even reply to that? Or I'm going to reply to them? And so it really kind of sifts it out. I know if they don't reply to that, they're probably not going to reply to anything. It's more like a politeness. Like, basically, you've been rude. You haven't replied to me. Did you get it? Like, and usually they come back, oh, yes, sorry, I'm busy with this and blah, blah, blah. It works quite well.
Okay. So my team like to use... are you receiving my emails? Which is pretty much a remix
similar
of your
vibe.
One.
Yeah.
I think I like to be a little bit more controversial. And I say, is prioritizing women with textured hair not a priority for you?
Oh.
And then they think, oh, yes, yes, sorry. We've just been really wrapped up. I'm like, yeah, because you're not prioritizing women with textured hair. And if that is not a priority, I want you to say it. Mm. And I get a response.
Like that.
Strategies. Emails. Strategies.
There's a lot that can go down there. You know,
absolutely.
A lot can get done
it goes
as well.
Down in the inbox.
So, yeah, you're popping off your emails, sending them out, and just that, you know, hustle mentality, whatever you want to call it, just keeping consistent and you get results.
Yeah.
And you start sending out your first boxes.
Mm-hmm.
You're packing them in your home.
Yes.
What's the transition story? You start in the bedroom.
The bedroom, then made our way to the front room, made our way to the dining room, made our way to the garage, and then all of the above. And then my mum said, this is not working. I need you to move it somewhere else. Like, you need to get out.
So things are clearly going well, though. Yeah. Like, what is that first 6 months like?
But you know what? I wouldn't even say it was 6 months, because the first 6 months I was still... So for 8 months, I was moonlighting. So I was doing both.
Mm.
And so I would say it was not till year two that I started to feel like, oh, okay, it's growing. But when you're in the midst of it, it's really hard to notice, because a new order's a blessing, but equally you're like, oh my gosh, like how am I going to fulfill these? And like capacity wise, I'm struggling to pack these boxes, but you're not making enough money to pay someone else to do it. Mm. And there's only so long that you can bribe your friends with pizza. So I'm like, this is great, but I just really need to like build proper infrastructure so that this feels like a business instead of like me just working all through the day and all through the night again. Like it felt like I was in the same position of almost burnt out, because I'm doing absolutely everything, like ordering tissue paper, packing the boxes, ordering the boxes, sealing the boxes, taking them to the post office. Like there's pictures of me at the post office with like the counters just stacked with boxes, and anyone that came in after me was so annoyed because it was literally going to take hours for them to work through my order. But yeah, so I have to, like, this has to grow, because I have to find a way to do this that isn't so taxing on me personally.
Yeah, and that's one of the big issues for most business owners that start something, you know, as a small team without investment.
Mm-hmm.
It's getting to that place where you can delegate set tasks,
absolutely,
free you up to work on the business as opposed to too much in the business.
Absolutely. And I think that's definitely something that I'm still working on, because I think especially when you care about things so much and there's clients that you've had for so long, like you just want to, like, you want to hover and you still want to be a part of it. And so I'm having to, like, literally every day tell myself, like, Jamila, remove yourself so that you can grow the business, because you can't be a part of, like, every pitch. You can't be a part of like every catch-up call. You can't, like, you have to remove yourself so that you can actually grow this.
So back at this stage, what do you do? What do you do to get out of this situation?
Rented a storage unit. So at the time, again, it's that thing of just doing things and not knowing how you're going to do it. I didn't know how we were going to afford it because I wasn't used to paying, like, it wasn't an expense that I had accounted for. But equally, I had no choice because my mum was ready to shut down the whole operation. So I was like,
I said no to this thing and now it's taking over my house. Get out.
So I was like, I'm going to have to get a storage unit and we'll have to pick and pack the boxes from there and send them from there. So for a long time, maybe even 2 years, we were working out of a storage unit. Wow. Like, we started with one, then two, then three. Then they started to like knock down the walls in between so we had more space.
Expansion.
Then they were getting sick of us because there was always deliveries or like there was always like tissue paper left out in the corridor. And so we're like, okay, we're going to need a space to call our own because working from here is not working. But again, that thing about showing up the best you can mm-hmm. and doing anything to the best of your ability is so important because on the customer side, I think people always thought that we were like this massive business. Mm. And I think they always thought that we had these really sophisticated warehouses where we packed their boxes. And I used to think if people saw where their boxes were coming from, I don't know that they would still buy them because, yeah, it was, we were resourceful, I will say, but it was not the operation that I wanted, but it got the job done at the time.
It wasn't as glamorous as the boxes looked.
No.
So you have, so you do move into a new warehouse,
mm-hmm.
find a nice space.
Yes.
And then you get a call one day.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the this is the entrepreneurial journey, right? There are always these moments where you're just like, I can't do this. Or yeah. Why? It's going to be these rollercoaster moments.
Why is usually the question.
What happens?
So we're actually in the storage space and I had just received a resignation from our warehouse manager. Oh. So I've reached out to her like, hey, can we catch up? Like, we'd love to talk through this. So we're catching up on that matter. And while we're there, we get a call to say, hey, Jamelia, someone's here and they want to talk to you. And I was like, who? Like, no one even knows that we operate from this. So who wants to talk to me and why right now? I was like, well, I'm in a meeting, so can they wait? And they were like, no, you need to come now. It seems quite important. Mm. So my heart is beating because I'm like, who is this?
Mm.
And then I get there and they show me their badges and they're like, I'm from Trade and Standards. And I'm like, okay.
Oh, again, it wasn't a call. They came up.
They actually came.
Person.
So the person on my team called, but they had shown up in person. And obviously the people on my team are intimidated because there's this figure that's got these badges.
Mm-hmm.
And even I think I kind of knew what Trading Standards was, but equally couldn't understand why they were here. And so I was like, okay. And they were like, yeah, there's been a we've been informed that there's a product on this premises that isn't compliant with the UK ingredients law. And I was like, okay. And I was pretty certain that, like, these were all natural hair products. So in my mind, they're natural hair products, natural ingredients. There's nothing to contest. So I was like, okay, fine. Like, sure, come up and show me like what it is. And so they started inspecting the boxes. Bearing in mind, there's about 1,000 boxes that have been packed at this point. And this is the last box before Christmas. So it needs to go out on time because I need to enjoy my Christmas break.
Wow. Yeah.
So
there's a lot of money on the line too.
Absolutely. Yeah. So the boxes are there, they're packed. And then they start picking up, they pick up one product from the box and it's a brand that has three products in that box.
Uh-huh.
And they're like, oh yeah, no, this label is a US label. It's not a UK label. And I'm like, okay. And she's like, yeah, so it can't go in the box. And I'm like, no, but this has been packed to go out to the customer. So yeah, maybe the next box, but as for this one needs to go out. And they were like, no, you need to take it out and you need to remove it. And we're going to inspect the rest of your warehouse.
Mm.
And I was like, oh my gosh. So like, where do I start? Like, I don't even know what to be annoyed about. I was like, should I be annoyed about the fact that you want to inspect my warehouse and I don't even know who you are? Like, do you need a permit to do this? Like, what are my rights?
Mm.
But equally, like, do you have to do this right now? And so I had to say to the team, like, sorry guys, but you're going to have to remove those products and we're going to have to find a substitute very quickly. Ugh. So literally days before Christmas, we were like ringing around our brand partners like, hey, we've got this slot. Can you fill it? Thankfully, one of our brand partners came through and did. But at the time, it just felt relentless. Mm. Like, first of all, a transition in the team, and it was such an important role. I managed to talk her around, thankfully. But then to have trading standards, and then I think it just instilled so much fear in me, because they were like, they gave me these papers, and then they were like making notes, and then they were asking me for all this information. And they were like, yeah, the fines are like 10K plus. And I was like, that's crazy. I don't even know how we would pay that. They were like, yeah, if this happens again, X, Y, Z. So that was one of the tougher times, and really, really frustrating, because it was pure naivety. I just didn't know. I assumed because a product was a natural hair product that it was fine to put in the box. I didn't understand the importance of labeling. I didn't understand the importance of compliancy. But again, how would I? Because I'd never worked in the industry before, and it was my first time doing this. Very frustrating. Mm.
It's just something you just have to go with when you're starting a company and doing it. You're just going to have to know that there are going to be these days where you just think, man, I don't want to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And you just have to push through it, because not every day is going to be rosy. But
no.
The feeling of doing something that you feel like, yeah, I'm here to do this, or this fulfills my passion, you know, having a few days like that,
yeah,
or weeks or months, compared to years in a job that you're not enjoying, is so worth it.
Yeah,
absolutely. And I think it also taught me an important lesson about, which I'm still learning, which is about like allowing myself grace. Because my initial thing, I was just so angry with myself, because I was like, not only have I, like, there's just so many implications. I've paid these people by the hour to pack these boxes. Now I've got to pay them to unpack it and repack it. So we're losing even more money. And then I was like, why didn't I know this? Like, how could I not, like, why didn't I dig deeper? Why didn't I do more research? But then I had to just keep reminding myself, like, this is your first time. Mm-hmm. You've never done this before. You're learning as you go along, and that's okay. And I was finding that, like, being hard on myself wasn't really helping me, so...
And that's it. And I think learning hard lessons is a good way of life showing you that you're on the right path.
Absolutely.
Because you're in a space that you haven't been in before. And that hard lesson there is something that you can always help. If you see another young person coming up in beauty or hair, you say, okay, if you're doing this, then make sure you've got this done and that done, because this could happen. I've experienced. And that's invaluable wisdom and experience to gain. Although quite painful at the time.
Very, very painful. Yes.
So how many boxes are you sending out today?
Oh, that's the $1 million question. So we don't disclose our box information of how many we send.
Okay.
But we send them globally.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm just looking to get an idea of the growth that's happened in the company, basically. Since then, how would you sort of chart that progress?
I think this will give you good perspective. So before the pandemic, we were growing quite steadily. There wasn't any like huge surges in growth. And then when lockdown happened, and BLM in particular, it did cause a huge rush. And it got to the point where we couldn't send as many boxes as we needed to. So supply couldn't meet demand.
Amazing problem to have.
Great problem.
Yeah.
Social popular, but tough as well, because you can just see all of the money that could come in to grow the company not being capitalized on.
Not to mention the complications of like trying to keep a warehouse open in the middle of a pandemic and all the fun that invites. And so we ended up building a wait list of 12,000 women who wanted to subscribe but couldn't.
Wow. And 12,000 people who wanted to subscribe but couldn't.
And couldn't.
Wow.
Yeah. And so we couldn't fulfill their order. It was really frustrating. Really frustrating. But for me, I shared it with another entrepreneur. He was like, I would have just found a way to serve them. And I think one, it's because he's a man. But two, it's because like the safety element of like keeping business open in a pandemic, I was so paranoid. Like the minute someone coughed or like the minute someone sneezed, I was like, you've got to go. And like people would come in and be like, oh, my mum's just got COVID. I'm like, you can't be here. You've got to go. So there were like so many layers of complexity, not to mention that the products that we were planning to put in the box, they actually got stuck in the US because all of the factories had shut down and everyone had stopped producing hair care and started producing sanitizers.
Right.
And when they did manage to load the ship, it was stuck on that side of the world and not this side. And so for a long time, there was like this weird period where it was like, great, we've got this growing wait list, but we can't even fill the boxes that people have already paid for because we can't get the stock because they're literally stuck on the other side of the earth. So thankfully things started moving sooner rather than later. And I think the fact that it was a global pandemic, people were quite gracious in understanding that things are going to take a bit longer than we anticipated.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was a tough time. It was a great time now that I look back retrospectively, but at the time it just felt like, yeah, this is the hardest thing I've done because you're trying to protect your warehouse team. You're trying to protect your office team. You're trying to keep them motivated. You're trying not to panic when someone in their family gets ill. You're trying not to worry about their family. You're trying not to worry about your own family. It was tough.
Tell us about you've done some pretty cool things in the time, like activations or like pop-ups and things like this. 2022,
mm-hmm.
come up with a genius idea.
Yes.
There's a Five Guys somewhere.
Yes.
And you come up with a concept. What was it?
Seven Girls. So we were celebrating 7 years of business.
Yeah.
And it actually wasn't the unit that we were meant to have. The unit that we have this year is the unit that we were meant to have last year.
Okay.
And the concept that we have this year was meant to be last year's concept.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing about entrepreneurship is that it's going to teach you how to pivot really quickly and get creative really quickly. So it was about a month to go before we're due to open the store and we get contacted to say that the property that we wanted actually got let out to someone else who wanted a longer lease. And so we can't have it. And so we had to find an alternative. And the only other option was like a derelict unit that had been abandoned for like maybe 7 years was the last time anyone traded in it.
Wow.
Coincidentally, it was next to Five Guys. And in our stash of ideas, we had this fast food idea where we were like, what if you could come into a space and like order hair products in the way that you order fast food?
Mm.
And then when we found out where the unit was and we went to visit it and it was like fitted out like a kitchen, I was like, guys, we have to do it. And then we were experimenting with names, like, well, what should we call it? And then I was like, let's just call it Seven Girls. And then we were like, okay, let's do it. So we called it Seven Girls, took a little bit of inspiration from our neighbors. And
so on one side you got Five Guys, on the next side you got Seven Girls.
Absolutely.
We'll put a picture of the shop on the episode. Yeah.
And then it was so funny. There were like tweets from the most random accounts. Like, I have no idea who Seven Girls are, but I love the two woman upship. And it was like a picture of Five Guys and then Seven Girls. And then people would walk in and be like, this is just genius. Like, this is genius marketing. But our neighbors, they didn't find it very funny.
They didn't find it funny either.
No, they couldn't appreciate the sentiment.
Not at all. I think the staff on the first day were like, haha, this is cool. And then management came in and they were fuming.
This is not cool.
Not cool. And then we had Uber drivers and Deliveroo drivers coming in like, and we were like, no, it's next door. And they were like, oh, okay. And then other people were like, is this a dessert parlor for Five Guys? And we were like, no, this is hair food, not food. So it was fun, but I quickly had to contact my solicitor to make sure that we were in the all clear because there were so many rumors going around about Five Guys, they're going to sue Treasure Dress. And I was like, we're not even here long enough for that to happen. Mm. And we're not even in the same industry, it's fine. So thank God in the end we were fine. But there were a few moments where I was like, did we take it too far? And the answer is probably yes. But it was fun.
You've got to have fun while you're on the journey.
There we go.
So tell us about the opportunity in this space, because you've gone from, you know, seeing hardly any products in the UK
mm-hmm.
to where are things at today? What is the opportunity in this space? And what is it? If you just break it down. Because retailers are getting quite interested in now, right?
Absolutely. The retailers are getting really interested. We released a white paper the year before last and then a trend report last year to highlight the fact that as much as progress is being made, it's not being made as quickly as we think it is. And a lot of the key stats that we were able to pull out was that Black women account for 2% of the population, but 10% of the spend on beauty in the UK.
Wow.
So like we massively over-index, but yet we're still not catered to in the same way. And what I found was a lot of American brands were treating the UK like they were treating the US. So they were assuming that the Black British consumer or the multicultural British consumer was the same as the African-American or multicultural American consumer. And they're completely different.
Mm.
Americans, around 50% of them shop for hair products in supermarkets. In the UK, only 1% shop for hair products in the supermarkets.
Wow. Where did they shop for this?
specialized shops. Okay. Because you know that there's no, you can't go into Tesco and expect that you're going to get your full wash day experience in the way that you want it to be. And so for me, that's like one of the most obvious indicators that there's still so much progress to be made. I was hoping that it would have happened during the pandemic, because if I was a CEO of Tesco, I would have built a beauty store inside Tesco, because there was no way that you could shop diverse beauty in lockdown, because the specialized shops were deemed non-essential retail, which meant that if you had afro, curly, kinky hair and you were used to going to those stores, you could no longer get your hands on shampoos or conditioners, which was great for me because that's what my business was built for. But for the independent shop owners, not great. And for the supermarkets, they lost out on a massive opportunity. So I'm still hoping that they read the paper and take heed, because I think a lot still should change and still can change. And I don't actually see it as a threat to our business, because our business is about discovery and it's about education. So it's about introducing people to products that they haven't considered before or they haven't tried before. Whereas retail, I feel like you have to have a previous experience with the brand in order to go to the shop and pick it up. Or you have to trust the retailer and trust that the selection that they're providing is well informed. And I don't think that stands true for any retailer in the UK. Like the buyers of the shops speak for themselves. Like, they're not diverse. The knowledge just doesn't exist.
So what is the story of Treasure Tress. What's the future? Where are things going? Anything you can share?
Yeah. So global expansion is always top of mind. And I think it's always been important, because it wasn't the intention initially. So the intention was the UK market. And then we started to notice like Dubai, Abu Dhabi, Japan, Korea, like loads of random places ordering our boxes. And that's when it dawned on me, like, oh, of course they are. Because if you're someone with textured hair, even if you were born and raised in that country, you're still going to struggle to find hair products. Or if you're from the US and the UK and you're struggling to find hair products, it is easier just to order the full set online and get it delivered to your door. So global perspective is always really, really important. Not to mention, I'm having a lot of fun with brick and mortar. Like, I really like having a physical store. So that might be an indication of what we do next. But the pop-up shop that we're running at the moment is going to be the longest standing one. So we started it off as a weekend, and now we're doing 5 months. So we're going to be in Birmingham for a pretty long time.
Wow, where can people find you then?
Link Street. So Birmingham, Upper West Boring, L12 on Link Street.
Cool.
It's called the Treasure Trust Laundrette.
So if I'm listening to this and I'm like, okay, Jamelia, I'm inspired. I've got my business idea.
Yeah.
What advice do you have for them? And they haven't started yet. They're in a full-time job.
It sounds so cheesy, but you have to just do it. Like, you have to just put something out there, create something and just put it out there. Even if you to this day, there's still things that I like post and I'm cringing, but I like post it and put my phone down and like go do something else. But you have to just do the uncomfortable and, as you said, step into the unknown so that you can see what else life has to offer. So just put it out there, just do it, and do it consistently so it can gain momentum. And one of the things I think is massively undervalued is the importance of listening to your customers, because everything that we do is a result of a customer saying like, oh, I wish you guys came to Birmingham. Oh, I wish that I could customize my box. Like, everything that we do is off the back of customer feedback. So I'd say put things out there and pay a lot of attention to people's response to it.
Love that. I think a nice note to finish on is something that you thought when your brother had his first daughter.
Yes.
What kind of thoughts were you thinking at that point?
Yeah, so when my brother and his partner were expecting my first niece, I knew that there was urgency around Treasure Tress and bringing the idea to life, because I just remember thinking, I don't want her to grow up in a world where she thinks that she's not beautiful in her natural state. So I remember growing up and watching TV, magazines, no one looked like me. Not seeing anyone with naturally textured hair. So like, even if there were black women on TV, they always had dead straight hair. So for me, I used to equate beauty with straight hair. Like, there was no in between. If you had textured hair, curly hair, wavy hair even, I didn't consider that to be beautiful. In order to be beautiful, you had to have straight hair. And it took me a long time to unlearn that. And I just thought, I don't want my niece to grow up in a world where she feels as though she has to have straight hair in order to be beautiful. And so I want to create a service and an experience and a community that she can be a part of and just be reminded, oh, I do look beautiful. And there's that lady who looks like me when I'm older and she wears her natural hair and she looks beautiful. And interestingly enough, one of the first ever Treasure Trust events was a Mummy and Me afternoon tea. And it was for mums and daughters with curly hair so that they could be in an environment where they could see each other. And I was able to bring my niece to it. And that was like the start of me feeling like, okay, I think there's some alignment here. Like what I intended to do, I'm starting to create the environments for her so that she does grow up with a lot of pride in her appearance.
Beautiful.
And what was really interesting earlier is I put up an Instagram story of just being here with the founder of Treasure Chest. And then Lauren saw it and she said, oh, Treasure Chest. And now what I realized is that she would have...
Who's Lauren?
Lauren, my partner. My beautiful partner.
There we go. Full name.
And she actually came across Treasure Tress when you were just at the subscriber stage. Mm. And that's why. And now she's like thinking, I think we'll go up to Birmingham and have a look.
Please do come down.
It's interesting how some things come full circle. Full circle.
Yeah.
So if I'm listening to this, I'm like, Treasure Tress is what I need in my life. Mm-hmm. How do people get it?
Subscribe. You literally go to the website. There's
What's
a few
the
different options. treasuretress.co.uk.
Okay. We'll put it in the comments, etc.
That'd be great.
Description.
You can receive the boxes monthly, bi-monthly, quarterly, or you can get an annual plan and prepay for your boxes. But it's, I think, especially for households and families, it's just such an efficient way to make sure that everyone's needs are served and that you don't have to worry about hair care on top of worrying about everything else. And if you're in Birmingham or the surrounding cities or you like a good train ride, come to our store because it's such a beautiful experience. And I'm really, really proud of the sales team there. The curl assistants are doing amazing at serving customers. Customers are coming in and saying, hey, I'm struggling with this, this and this. And they're like, perfect. This is the box that you need. These are the products you should consider. So like customers that come in and they're like, it's for my child. They're like, perfect. Try this vegan, cruelty-free brand. These are the different steps in the wash day. Or do you know what? I wear my hair straight a lot of the time. Cool, no worries. Let's go with these brands. And they're able to build the box to cater to what your hair needs.
Wow.
So I'm really proud of them. They're doing really, really well.
I love that. My hair's quite dry. Can I go and speak to them?
Absolutely.
And be like, will they sort me out?
Absolutely. Okay. I've got the perfect brand already.
Oh, brilliant. Okay, sounds good. We'll summarize. I'll share what I think people can learn from your story. And then we have a poem. That's being written.
I'm amazed that you've been able to do this.
It's an amazing skill. It's incredible. I think, people can just be inspired by you, not only just that story of identifying a problem that you have.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds so simple, like, oh yeah, I had this issue, I couldn't find a product, so I started this company. But the reality of the work and graft and just... to get started and turn it into something,
mm-hmm.
is very rare, actually. Mm-hmm. And so people can just be inspired to go, okay, all right, what are the things that I struggle with? What are the pain points? What are the challenges? And let me just set myself a task to just start something. And you can do the first few months while doing your work. You know, you don't have to go crazy and just quit everything and dive straight in. If you want to do that, do it. But you can spend a period and just test it, and you might find, actually, I don't care about this, or nobody wants this, or you might find, like you did, that actually quite a few people do, including Palmer's. And that gives you that first sign that, oh, there's something in this, and I might be right. And just to then, as you said, consistency, keep working on it every day, which is why that great quote from Steve Jobs is so famous, where he's like, you gotta love it. You gotta love it, otherwise you will give up.
Absolutely.
Because there'll be those days where you're just tired and emotional or whatever, but if you've really got a passion for it, that's where the consistency comes in, and you can end up 8 years later building an amazing company with a great culture, it seems, and pop-up shops and a great future ahead. So yeah, I think it's a very inspiring story.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, that's for sure. I think taking action on an area that was underserved has proved to be a great how can I say this? Taking action on an area of beauty products that is massively underserved has yielded you great a great company out of it, and also a great thing for people to see and connect to that never really felt heard or catered for before. I think that's brilliant. And I'm really quite interested in how you're going to grow from here, because it's not just a UK problem. As you're discovering, this is like a worldwide issue where people are looking for what you need. Harking back to your days in Beijing, where you had nothing that you could get, to now being able to supply products to those exact people that are in the same situation. So I feel like this poem will summarize what I've taken from it, what we all may have taken from it. And without further ado, I'll get into it. Travel and adventure from life's beginnings, seeing a society that can reflect her future success. With first her eyes set on a future in law, but with results just under the passing score, a pivot choice changed her vision she had set. Setting sails to new ports, she then landed in New York, where so many hair care products were provided for curly and thick hair. Having to fly back to England, she found the best products still missing, that the products for hair just were not there. You never know who's watching, so give 100%, as oftentimes it will come back around. Taking the leap of faith, refining your approach, can truly build your prime dream to grow up from the ground. From an idea to worldwide sales, success victorious over fails, now with insights to cater to future consumers. Don't ever suppress your dreams. True from the story we have seen, whether you're a startup, entrepreneur, or late bloomer.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing.
Thank you for sharing with us today. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you, guys. I've really, really enjoyed the conversation.
Good. And that is how you became founder of The Treasure Tress.
Amazing.